Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the Green Party's agenda for 2016, confronting domestic and foreign crisis and challenges. My guest, Dr. Jill Stein. Dr. Stein is the 2016 presidential candidate for the Green Party and a strong advocate for greater third-party representation in election campaigns and debates. Dr. Stein is a medical physician of internal medicine and a pioneer in advocating environmental health issues in Massachusetts. During her presidential run in 2012, she received enough votes, making her the most successful woman presidential candidate in U.S. history. Dr. Stein is a Harvard Magna Cum Laude graduate and received her doctorate from Harvard Medical School. Over the years, she's been active in Massachusetts campaigns to better protect women and children from toxic pollution that has been associated with learning disabilities. She is also on the National Board of Directors of the organization Physicians for Social Responsibility, favoring a national universal health care program, and has won awards for her public health efforts to clean water policies and children's health. Her website is jill2016.com. Nice to have you with us today, Jill.
It's great to be with you again, Gary. And just for the record, I should just update that bio to note that in running for office, I have stepped away from all nonprofit board positions and so on, just so as not to be incriminating any of my friends out there in the advocacy world.
All right. I'd like to focus upon first domestic issues and policies, and then later turn to foreign affairs, defense, and national security. I think three of the most popular issues on the campaign trail so far would be reining in the corporate and banking elite and diverting some of its wealth towards raising up standards of living in this country and job creation, and then a single-payer universal health care or expansion of Medicare to cover all, and free public college and university tuition. On my noon radio show today, I had a guest who addressed the runaway inequality and the ever-widening gap between the rich and the poor and the decimation of a real middle class. And that's what our nation is facing. How would your presidency narrow the inequality gap? And what safeguards would you put in place so that the corporate elite and the banks and the private mega industries lobbying to get all of this on their side, and they're lobbying with many politicians that are not representing their own constituents but are representing these special interest groups? So could you go through these issues one at a time and take your time? You get the full hour to explore this.
Wonderful. Okay, great. And of course, as usual, you're raising all the critical issues, and indeed we are facing, you know, an unprecedented crisis of truly epic proportions, you know, converging crisis of economy, ecology, peace, and democracy. We need transformational solutions. And I might add, you know, in my view, the problem is not only the billionaires, but it's the political parties that empower and serve the billionaires. So just to put that in perspective, I think, you know, we need to vigorously go after real solutions that are within our reach and are available. And we also need a new and unencumbered political process that is not held hostage by predatory banks, fossil fuel giants, war profiteers, and the usual suspects. So, you know, these two things really go hand in hand. We need the solutions, but we also need an independent process. And as you allude to, the way that we run our political system and the way that we fund it has sort of, you know, influence peddling baked into it, whether you're talking about the banks or the fossil fuel companies or the weapons manufacturers. You know, how do we break that connection? So one thing that we can do, which is, you know, rather straightforward, is to create pay-to-play protections, you know, so that if you are a corporation and you are making campaign contributions, then by definition, you have exempted yourself from government contracting. And this is done in some countries around the world. It's not really done here, but it is possible to put in these pay-to-play protections. The better solution, of course, is a constitutional amendment that prohibits corporations from pretending that they are human beings and from asserting human rights and privileges like participating in our political system. We really should have a constitutional amendment that clarifies that corporations cannot pay to play. They cannot be part of this political system. And hand in hand with that, we should have a political system which is publicly funded, which is not funded by private money whatsoever. Also, connected to that is freeing the public airwaves so that these airwaves, which in fact belong to us, the public, should be available for public purpose and public use. That means in elections that qualified candidates should have access to free use of the airwaves. And the minute you do that, the cost goes out of the political process so that we, the people, can thereby actually afford to fund this and not have to pay the billions of dollars that currently goes into this mockery of democracy that we call the American elections. So that just, you know, by way of sort of breaking the this tie, this incredible connection, joined at the hip between big money and politics. That connection has to be broken so that we can actually pass the good policies. And I'll just speak, maybe I'll just say a few words about the banking cartel, you know, and how we break that stranglehold on our economy, because it has not been broken. And in spite of the 2007 crash, which was caused by waste, fraud, and abuse on Wall Street, and which the Democratic Party, which held both the White House and two houses of Congress, chose to essentially ignore, and when the public was clamoring for, you know, a bailout for homeowners and for everyday working people, what the political establishment did was bail out Wall Street to the tune of $16 trillion and counting, and they gave us a new banking law, the so-called Dodd-Frank, which has left the banks bigger than ever, more on the verge of massive failure and collapse, which will bring down the economy once again. And the problem has not been fixed. Yet it could be fixed in a heartbeat, and I'll just say one way that we can fix this reckless risk-taking, not really risk-taking, profiteering on Wall Street, is to simply implement safeguards that the president has the power to implement. We don't even need to wait to get this through Congress. And these are a couple of proposals that have been laid on the table by Bill Black, the author of the book, Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own It. And to simplify this proposal or set of proposals, essentially the president can insist that banks have basically have to have the cash on hand, so-called minimum capital requirements. They need to have the cash on hand proportional to the risk. And that amount can be set essentially by the White House and its agencies. So you can set cash requirements that would require the banks to downsize right now. And the other thing is to reestablish the rule of law on Wall Street, which currently does not exist, you know, whereby you have the criminals who are running the show and getting away with it. We can reinstate basically the criminal referral process so that these agencies are being policed, and instead of the Securities and Exchange Commission looking the other way, instead of the FBI basically canceling and terminating all of its agents that were supposed to be policing white-collar crime, we bring that back. This isn't so, you know, complicated. It's not rocket science. We can apply the rule of law, and we can break up the big banks. So that would be one very important place to start. Let me give you a word in edgewise, Gary, and you know, any thoughts you have or direction you'd like me to go from here.
Well, those who are suffering the most from disaster capitalism's inequality policies are minorities, and particularly African-American community. 24%, that's one quarter of black households, earn less than $15,000 a year. It is 15% for Hispanic families. Single moms, regardless of color, are also suffering, and this is fueling a new rise in racism and gender tensions and civil rights violations in America today. How do you see racial equality as an economic issue, and what would you specifically do to address it?
Great question. And racism in our economy is a reality, and it's played off of by demagogues. Demagogues, of whom there are more than one out there in the presidential race, and, you know, playing on people's incredible levels of stress and levels of economic insecurity, and trying to blame the crisis generated by a predatory capitalist economy, trying to blame that on the victims. And on the most vulnerable victims, in fact, whether it's African Americans or Latinos or immigrants, you know, this is all wrong. And this is what you get with a policy of austerity. Austerity basically breeds economic insecurity and extreme right-wing populism, you could say, or you could also call it proto-fascism. This is a very dangerous moment, and it makes it so important that we actually address this economic inequality, which goes hand in hand with the racial inequality. And I want to say it's not just hand in hand, because the racial inequality is superimposed on the economic inequality. So, for example, African Americans who have a college degree have at least as high an unemployment rate as Caucasians who only have a high school degree. You know, so there is racism compounding class here, which is very problematic, and it needs to be solved at many levels. We call for, in my campaign, we call for a national action plan for racial justice now that addresses racism in the economy, in school segregation, in housing segregation, you know, and the legacy of redlining, which has really prohibited the African American community from accumulating wealth. And in fact, in the Wall Street crash of 2007, what we saw happen was absolutely outrageous. The African American family previously had on average 10 cents on the dollar that a white family had of accumulated wealth. Well, in the crash, that 10 cents went down to 5 cents. So a lot of this had to do with the destruction of housing wealth, which is you know, absolutely intolerable. And we must also fix the crisis of racism in policing, in courts, and in our prison system. So it's really this pervasive racism that's hardwired into all aspects of society and the economy, for which there are real solutions. So, for example, on the policing issue, we can ensure that all communities have police review boards so that communities are controlling their police and not the other way around. We can ensure that all communities have full-time investigators so that all cases of violence at the hands of police, that is, of deaths and injuries, become investigated so that perpetrators are held accountable and don't just live inside the system with impunity like they can get away with now. We call for an end to the drug wars and for legalizing drugs, or shall we say legalizing marijuana, which is really the workhorse of the illegal drug industry and the violence that accompanies it, which is the biggest health threat of illegal substances. And we call for treating health, shall we say, treating substance use and abuse as a health problem and not as a criminal problem, and discharging from jails all the people, in particular people of color and men of color, who've been unfairly criminalized and incarcerated. They should be turned back out to become productive members of their communities and their society. And our Green New Deal, to speak to the economic question, which is compounding racism, the Green New Deal would prioritize, and the Green New Deal is our overarching plan for putting everyone to work. Everyone who needs a job gets a living wage job in the productive, clean, green economy that creates healthy communities, healthy workers, and a healthy planet. And it does so on an emergency basis because we have an economic emergency as well as a climate emergency. And by aiming first at the communities where the unemployment is highest, this is, you know, invariably the communities of color where this economic emergency is at its most extreme.
You oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership and its Atlantic equivalent. Even if these don't pass, we still have regressive free trade bills in place that continue to do damage and take away jobs from the U.S. What would you do to remedy the damage being caused by these elitist trade bills? Would you, and this is a yes or no, would you rescind us from the NAFTA, CAFTA, and would you remove us from the World Trade Organization in order to reestablish a completely new manufacturing working class environment in the United States?
Certainly, these trade agreements are very destructive, and they allow multinational corporations to basically call the shots. And these shots have been devastating all over the world. So these agreements need to be canceled and turned into fair trade agreements, not a corporate free-for-all. The corporate trade agreements are essentially a corporate free-for-all, and they need to be transformed into fair trade agreements. We need to go back to the drawing boards on them.
Your agenda includes guaranteed jobs for all who need to work and guaranteed living wage. How would you achieve it specifically? And would it in any way align itself with the CCC of the 1930s, Civil Conservation Corps? Would you have a urban renewal program? Would you de-ghettoize America? Would you, for example, have a infrastructure program similar to Roosevelt's CCC program? Give us some specifics on how you have people to work, because right now there's 106 million Americans who could work who are not for various reasons. That's a lot of people to put back to work.
Yes, it sure is. And, you know, basically we would create the right to a job, the right to a living wage job, and a job that creates a healthy and productive community-based economy. So we're not talking about corporate jobs. We're talking about community-based jobs, small businesses and worker cooperatives, and government jobs. And in fact, the public, believe it or not, actually supports this, supports the notion that people have a right to a job. And if the private sector cannot provide them, then the public sector shall, which is essentially the policy that FDR followed in the New Deal. So we call for a Green New Deal, which is an emergency program because we have an economic emergency. But in this case, it's a Green New Deal. So it's like what got us out of the Great Depression, except that it has a focus on transforming our economy on an emergency basis to a green economy that we need to survive, let alone to thrive, in the future. And specifically the focus is that everyone who wants a job gets a full-time and living wage job. The program is federally financed but locally controlled, so that communities get to define through a participatory budgeting process, which is firewalled against influence peddling and pay-to-play, communities decide what they need to become sustainable economically, ecologically, socially as well. So that's how we define sustainable. It's not just the environment. It's also being socially sustainable. And the communities can say what they need. The focus is particularly on democratizing our energy with public control and public purpose to that energy, and creating 100% clean renewable energy by 2030 so that we can actually solve the climate crisis in real time. That it must be solved in so that we don't go down with the ship here. So really, it recognizes that we are in a climate emergency here, every bit as much as an economic emergency. It focuses also on creating sustainable food systems, because the industrialized food system that we currently have is both a disaster for our health as well as a disaster for the climate and other aspects of the environment, biodiversity, and so on. And by the way, we are in the middle of a sixth grade extinction, which is another emergency that really goes hand in hand with the climate, or shall we say more broadly, environmental emergency that we're in. So that second focus then is creating healthy, sustainable local food systems, ensuring that all communities have a right to accessible, affordable, healthy, nutritious whole food, because this pablum that we are being forced fed now of processed, nutrient-poor food is extremely toxic for our health. The third component here is transportation, and I would add to that recreation and transportation, because we want to be able to, in order to be a truly healthy society, we need to be able to recreate, and we need to be able to move around instead of being locked into vehicles that are producing toxic emissions. So you want to have safe sidewalks, and kids can walk and bike to school, and not just kids, but, you know, of all ages and adults, and also to get to work and to get to your transit hubs. So we need a rational transportation system, which is not rocket science. And in addition, we need to restore ecosystems. So yes, this is very much like the Civic Conservation Corps that you mentioned in the Great Depression. Restoring ecosystems is a critical part of this, and part of the general infrastructure that society and a sustainable and just economy depends on. And the timeline here needs to be an emergency. So that means 100% clean renewables by 2030, and it also means an immediate ban on all new fossil fuel infrastructure and exploration. So no new pipelines, no new fracking towers, no more offshore oil. Forget it about the Arctic. You're not going to plunder the Arctic and our public lands any further, et cetera. That is sort of the focus of the program, and what it achieves then is to revive our economy, to turn the tide on climate change, and importantly, to make wars for oil obsolete, because when you have 100% clean renewable energy forever, you don't need the friggin' wars, and you cannot justify those friggin' wars. So the enormous savings from that, from being able to render the military budget obsolete and massively reduce it, puts hundreds of billions of dollars back into the economy. That's one way that this can be paid for, by the way. And the other way to pay for this is that our health is so massively improved by having a healthy food system and by having a pollution-free environment. So you don't have, you know, the air pollution driving your asthma, your heart attacks, your strokes, et cetera, and your cancers, I might mention. Our health gets so much better that our health expenditures plummet. And we saw this happen, for example, in Cuba when their oil pipeline went down with the founding of the Soviet Union. And when that happened, their death rates from diabetes went down 50%. Their death rates from heart attacks and strokes went down 25 to 35%. All-cause mortality went down 20%. And how much did they spend? $0. We are spending $3 trillion and counting a year on what's not a health care system but a sick care system. So it's very critical, you know, to change that for our health here. So our health is a major beneficiary of this Green New Deal program. It's a win-win-win for our climate, for our economy, for our health, and for global peace and security.
Joe, where do you stand on Bernie Sanders' proposal for free public and university college education? And if you would fight for that, how would you fund it? And also, what plans do you have for relieving or reducing college debts that are currently $1.2 trillion? We also have this, and to me this is the most egregious part. 55% of college graduates coming out of a BA, BS program do not have jobs at all. Over 80% of those who do get jobs, it's not in their area of specialization. It's frequently service jobs. Many are having to live at home. One of the things that this generation is used to, that my generation, your generation, would not have thought of, graduating from college and going back home into our bedrooms, we would have gone out and had a life. They cannot afford that. But now, and it's happening regularly, U.S. Marshals and SWAT teams are now going after people who have not paid their student debt. The latest was just this last week, where seven fully armed in combat gear U.S. Marshals showed up because a person was late in paying their student loan. And by the way, that particular student loan was $1,200. And so this, I can assure you, that raid costs a lot more. Now we go from that, this is an interconnected issue, into private prisons, where you're seen by a private judge, you're locked in a private jail, you're charged $135 or so per day. You then get out to see a probation officer that you must pay. Now, if you cannot pay for your daily maintenance in jail, you cannot pay for the judge, nor can you pay for the hearing officer, who's your probation officer, then you're remanded back to jail. And if the irony of it is, if you're too poor to pay a bill, and this is just not for students, this is even a $40 traffic ticket, you could end up paying thousands of dollars if you have no support system, and because they're not turning off the clock. And then you're paying compounding interest. And we're dealing right now with over 3.5 million Americans who earn $2 or less per day. We're dealing with 18 million hungry children who go to bed each day food insecure. We're dealing with approximately 1.6 million children coming out of school each day who have no home to go to. And we have 255 million Americans who are right above, at, or below the poverty line. And nothing that I can currently see is addressing their issues except the return of debtors' prisons, the enormous profit made off people not being able to pay debit and credit cards or payday loans, and some of those payday loans are averaging 600 to 1,000% interest, and yet no one in this campaign is addressing them, the government is not addressing them, and I'd like to know how you would address these issues. Take your time, please.
Wonderful. I think you've said it really well. This is why the House of Cards is coming down. This cannot hold. You know, this is a rebellion that's underway, and this is why, in my view, it's so critical that we not allow this system to carry on. Because while these realities that you've just described are, you know, getting worse by the day, you have the wealthy few who are getting richer all the time, 20 mega billionaires right now in the U.S. who have as much as half of the U.S. population, or 62 billionaires, most of whom are in the U.S., who have as much as 3.5 billion people, the poorer half of the world. So the few are getting richer all the time, while the many are becoming impoverished beyond belief, and the political system, the two predator parties, continue to make this worse by inflicting more austerity on everyday people while they squander trillions of dollars on Wall Street bailouts, on wars for oil that are blowing back at us, by the way, and tax favors for their wealthy friends. So we should not, we must not allow them to talk us into powerlessness. And this comes back to the whole conversation about third parties that maybe we'll touch on later in this conversation. But this is why we must revolt. This is what Chris Hedges calls, the moral imperative of revolt. And to remember, as Alice Walker says, that the biggest way people give up power is by not knowing we have it to start with. We not only have solutions to these problems, we have enough numbers that we can win the day. And going back to the first issue you talked about here, student debt, there are 43 million young people, and now no longer young people, who are held hostage by student debt in an economy that does not allow that debt to be repaid. They kept their side of the bargain, but the economy did not. The economy tanked on them. We saw fit to bail out the crooks who tanked the economy to the tune of $16 trillion. It's about time we bailed out the students. And this would be an approximately $1.3 trillion quantitative easing, which basically means it's a digital solution. It essentially expands the money supply, but in a way that is very productive. This is an enormous stimulus package for the economy to actually unleash 43 million people to do what they are trained to do, to allow them to take risks, to set up new enterprises and cooperatives, and actually be creative members of the economy instead of being debt slaves, and to spend their dollars back into the economy, stimulating it instead of just paying bad bank debt. And the critical thing to remember here is that these 43 million young people, and not so young people, is a plurality of the presidential vote in a three-way race. So this is a problem that can solve itself because there's only one candidate that will cancel student debt, and that is my campaign. 43 million people who come out to vote green to cancel student debt can do so knowing that they can actually take over this election and win it, not only to end student debt and to make public higher education free, but the rest of the agenda of justice that they largely support, because this generation has been the victim of the predatory economy and the predatory political system. So they've kind of grown up with the progressive agenda, having lived the need for it. So the name of the game here is getting that word out to a self-mobilizing, self-organizing, and highly communicative constituency that can go out there on Facebook like no other demographic and actually make this happen. And on free college, yes. And I just want to say that we've been here, and I must say the Green Party has always supported free college, free public higher education as a public good. So it's not something we've picked up from Bernie Sanders. We've been here all along, and I was very loud and clear about this in the last election as well. We have a lot in common with Bernie, and this is one of those things. You know, the main difference with Bernie is that we don't support a counter-revolutionary party. We think you need a revolutionary party to have a revolutionary campaign. Otherwise, you just get sucked back into that counter-revolutionary party. So for many people, we are Plan B for Bernie's campaign when the Democratic Party uses its inevitable kill switch on Bernie's progressive campaign, which is, they have a history of many decades of doing that. So we're here as Plan B. Free college, how do you pay for it? So let's say it's approximately $60 billion. No problem, because we've already talked about the Green New Deal that allows us to slash the military budget, because you don't need the friggin' wars for oil. And we spend about $1 trillion a year on the military. Let's say, conservatively, we could cut that 50%. That's half a trillion dollars or $500 billion right there per year that we save. So there's plenty of money to pay that $60 billion a year cost. You know, that's the whole point of moving to a foreign policy, actually, that promotes security rather than terror, which is what our current foreign policy promotes, and I'm sure we'll have a chance to get to that as well. But in creating a more effective and more secure foreign policy, we can then put our dollars into true security here at home, and that includes and readily covers the costs of free college. And as I mentioned, the cost of canceling debt is basically handled through a quantitative easing, which is essentially to say by expanding the money supply as the economy becomes more productive.
Of course, I'm guessing that you would close down the debtors' prisons.
Yes. We need to end privatized prisons, for one thing. I mean, this is a real outrage that the prison industry should be privatized at all. So we would end prison privatization, end the concept of throwing people into prison for debt, ensure that, you know, I mean, we would basically be canceling those student debts. And by the way, this is something over which the president has pretty strong control, because the president appoints the Fed, and the Fed, in turn, determines the quantitative easing. So, I mean, this is why I think the real instrument of change right now, it's always been the younger generation. And that younger generation has been missing in action because it's too busy, you know, working three jobs and trying to stay out of debt. So canceling student debt, you know, it liberates young people to become active again and to help drive this forward, and assuring people that they have something to come out and vote for now. 80% of young people stayed home in 2012. Why should they vote for two parties who've been basically putting them into debtor's prison? The differences between the two parties are extremely small on this issue in terms of policies that they've promoted and adopted. And, you know, even recently, Congress's latest move was to permit the harassment with daily phone calls, a barrage of phone calls and text messages to people who are in debt from the collection agencies. So young people have not been done any favors by the predatory political parties, but by getting the word out that there is a new show on the block here and a very clear program for ending student debt as the first priority upon taking office, so as to liberate our ground troops and be able to fight this battle going forward for the rest of the progressive agenda as well.
Okay. For the past 40 years of struggle with big pharma and the federal health agencies, which now serve as mouthpieces for the drug industry's interest, I've observed how our present disease management-based medical establishment has become monolithic. It's a well-oiled machine that reaches throughout the branches of government and mainstream media, and yet the quality and affordability of our health care is utterly dismal. So first, just a brief answer, since we know what you've said earlier in the program about single-payer, that you've covered, but how would you deal with the enormous influence of the pharmaceutical industries, their control over the U.S. Public Health Service, the FDA, the National Cancer Institute, where people ask for money, money, money. There's over 200,000 private contractors all lined up to get money. You cannot trust the peer-reviewed journals anymore. The think tanks and the front groups that send the medical specialists out to tell us about this miracle and that miracle, they're never talking about their own financial conflicts of interest. Mm-hmm. So, and it's now a major concern because the amount of drugs people are on, the quality of those medications, especially the antipsychotic and antidepressives, for children, they're now, in just the last year, there were thousands of babies as young as 6 months of old being given the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. To me, this is a crime against humanity, but I'd like to see, since I live in this field, this is where I spend my time every day, I'd like to see what your thoughts are on challenging big pharma, the medical industrial complex, the insurance industries that control much of this, and the legislators that they bought, and the revolving door between a Gerberding who goes from overseeing vaccine safety at the CDC to running Merck's vaccine program and then just selling $3 million worth of stock that she got, and yet we don't consider that at all unusual. Your thoughts, please.
Yes, regrettably, it's the rule. It's not the exception in how corporate America and our political system, our regulatory and legislative system works, you know, and our political parties, I would add, which are funded by the same money. So this is why I belong to a political party that does not accept corporate money and does not accept money from anyone who hires a lobbyist for a private corporation, because it is a clear sign of having a conflict of interest. And in order to address this problem, you know, I mean, it could be done really simply. There, you know, let's make a rule that there can be no revolving door between industry and, you know, and our public agencies. No revolving door, period. And in addition, you know, campaign contributions should not be allowed from private money. That's a taller order, but to end the revolving door is, you know, that is really achievable. And that is something that, you know, should be instituted and implemented. And, you know, certainly we should expect from any presidential candidate that you would support that they would vow not to appoint any agency head or subhead, any important agency executive who's coming out of industry. And in addition, to not appoint, to make contingent, make these appointments contingent on a signed statement that the appointee will not then go back into industry either. So that, you know, there are ways that don't depend on Congress to end the revolving door right now by using our votes to ensure that that we can end the revolving door. You know, that's one way that we can begin to do this, and I couldn't agree with you more. It's absolutely essential. People do not trust our agencies. You know, we've just seen the EPA, for that matter, you know, caught red-handed in the Flint scandal, you know, where the EPA executives, or I should say officials, you know, were not doing the oversight and the supervision that should have been done, and the state, environmental agencies were not alerting people and were, you know, looking the other way, and in fact, those officials who did see the crisis were actually fired. They were removed from their positions. So we have extremely corrupted agencies right now, and the public does not trust them. And there's no way that they are going to earn the trust of the public until it becomes clear that they are actually working in the public interest and not for corporate America.
We have a mental health crisis in this country. This is a crisis in the making by the drug companies trying to pathologize normal behavior and wanting now to push laws that every American would have a mental health checkup to determine if they have a disease, a brain chemical imbalance that then Big Pharma could help fix. They tried it with teen screen. They didn't get very far with that, but they're having greater effect. And then the pharmaceutical companies are looking at depression, anxiety as epidemic, and therefore wanting to jump in there and recommend your doctor screen adults and then treat them immediately with medications. And I was fighting George Bush's 2003 teen screen. It was a national disaster. It destroyed some lives. What would you do to help people who are going through a crisis that we all go through at different times, different traumas, when things are out of our control, and we start responding emotionally in ways that frequently other people feel uncomfortable with. And historically, people had guidance. People had their priest, their rabbi, their friends, their family, their grandparents, a council of elders who could talk with them, who would help them through transitions. Today, all that has been swept aside, and we're told, take a pill. How would you deal with that?
This is, this is unfortunately the tip of the iceberg in a health system where health has been medicalized in the worst sense of the word. Health has been sort of reduced to chemical, that is pharmaceutical intervention, period. And medical schools, become a training ground for pharmaceutical promotion and medical procedure promotion. And, we see this from the pharmaceutical agents, that are just combing the medical schools from the day you set foot in that door, and who have their freebies and their free lunches and their drug talks and it's much more pervasive than that because it's the budgets of our medical schools themselves that then become dependent on joint patents with pharmaceutical companies. And the whole institution of healthcare, including mental health care, becomes focused on selling medications. This is about a system that serves profit rather than people. And it needs to be, turned on its head. It needs to be about serving people and not profit. We have research institutions that are dedicated to pharmaceutical research, and we neglect addressing the causes of these problems, which are very often related to bad nutrition and poverty and chemical pollution and air pollution and so on. We pharmaceuticalize our approach to health, and this is a disaster. And it makes the point, looking at what happened in Cuba, how they had their health revolution simply from moving to a green economy and a just economy where they didn't have poverty. In doing so, they had an absolute health miracle that cost them nothing. Where basically they had good, healthy food and pollution prevention and active mode of transportation. So we need to really take a lesson from that, and we can not only create a much healthier society, it's like, let me put this another way, the most important thing we can do to improve our health is to stop allowing corporate America to make us sick.
Jill, I have one final question for you, and we have 5 minutes to the end of the show. You and Bernie Sanders are similar on some issues, but radically different on foreign policy. Mm-hmm. For over 16 months, the United States was supposedly fighting ISIS. Then we find out they didn't once bomb any of the oil convoys, that some of those convoys were 12,000 trucks going from Turkey to Iraq, and then the ISIS was going from Syria and Iraq into Turkey, unloading its oil, getting about $1 million to $4 million a day. Then Turkey was selling it to other countries and using it itself or in the black market. That was one way we could have stopped ISIS's a lot of their funding. We did not. Russia comes in and bombs those whole convoys, and suddenly ISIS is under siege, and then Russia starts to protect the interests of the Syrian people. We, on the other hand, protect the interest of the Wahhabists, the most radical form of Islam, in the Sunni groups of Bahrain and Qatar and the United Arab Emirates, and in Saudi Arabia. And in Saudi Arabia, just today, a person was found to be a heretic for disagreeing with God's commandments. 2,000 lashes, as you know, that a person cannot survive 2,000 lashes and 10 years in prison. They had the largest number of beheadings this year, 47 in one day. And yet they're our ally because we buy billions of dollars, or they buy billions of dollars in arms from us. We're supplying the world with arms. They're going out and they're funding al-Nusra. They're funding al-Qaeda. We bombed Libya. That was Hillary's bombing campaign that she was motivated and behind it. And look what the number one country as far as women, equality, standard of living, healthcare system, shared wealth was in Libya. Today it is a complete failed state and it's a training base for ISIS and other radical groups. How would you do it differently?
Thank you for a really compelling summary of what's wrong with our foreign policy. We need a foreign policy based on international law, human rights, and diplomacy, not on total economic and military domination. And over the past 15 years, you know, we've had these disastrous wars for oil that have cost us $6 trillion, that's $75,000 per household, have killed over a million people in Iraq alone, which is not winning us the hearts and minds of people in the Middle East, and we've killed or maimed tens of thousands of U.S. soldiers, and what we have to show for it is failed states, worse terrorist threats on every count. Every one of them is far worse, and we've created the new terrorist threat, ISIS, which grew out of the chaos in Iraq, and mass refugee migrations to the tune of 60 million people in the last year alone, which are tearing apart the Middle East and the European Union, for that matter. So this is an absolute catastrophe, and, you know, it boggles the mind that all of our politicians are talking about more of the same. All of the political candidates, I must say, are talking about more of the same, whether it's the U.S. leading the charge, which is what Hillary Clinton wants, or for the Saudis to lead the charge, which is what Bernie Sanders has been talking about, letting the Saudis do it, empowering the Saudis. But as you've pointed out, the Saudis are the problem. They're not the solution. It's not just the Saudis, but it's been U.S. collaboration with Saudis, which has generated terrorism from its inception. Back, you know, this is global jihad. Going back to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, this was a creation of the U.S., the CIA, and the Saudis that brought in foreign fighters, armed them. Saudis provided training, and we together provided financing, and this was to make trouble for the Russians. Well, what it did was, you know, it created al-Qaeda, it strengthened the Taliban, you know, and it has just given rise to this cycle of violence. We've been partners with the Saudis here for, you know, for a long time, since the Second World War, when the Saudis provided our oil and we agreed to look the other way on Wahhabism, which is essentially the prototype of jihad terrorism. So we need to start on a new footing here with a policy based on international law and human rights and not be in the business of selling weapons, and it's been $100 billion over the past 8 years. We cannot sell weapons to human rights violators and war criminals, which the Saudis are, and, you know, our other partners, the Israelis, are doing their part here as war criminals as well. We've been providing them with $8 million a day to maintain their army. So we need a policy based on principle here. And we can do that, you know, because we must do that. But in addition, as we move to the green economy on an emergency basis, we are no longer dependent on that oil. And specifically, we are calling for a peace offensive. This isn't about throwing up our hands and walking away. This is about ending the funding of terrorism and ending the arming of terrorism. That's how we stop wars.
Jill, we're right up the end of the show. I just need two yes or no questions answered, please, because we're out of time. Will you pull the teeth on the CIA from regime change and assassinations and around the world?
Absolutely.
All right. And will you see that there's a fairness in the treatment of Palestinians where Israel does not dominate every single issue?
Absolutely. We cannot fund Israel while they are violating human rights and international law, period. We need to have an even-handed, principled policy. And can I make one last comment? Do I have
real quick?
Okay, which is just that, you know, we've got the answers, we've got the solutions, but what we really need is to recognize the political power that we have. the politics of fear, you know, that tells us we have to vote our fears and not our values, you know, has basically created everything we were afraid of. All those reasons you're told to vote for the lesser evil, we've gotten all that by the droves. Democracy doesn't live in a vacuum. It needs our voices, our values, not our silence, not our fears. We have to be the moral compass. The clock is ticking. This is the Hail Mary moment. It's time to reject the lesser evil and stand up and fight for the greater good, like our lives depend on it, because they do. We can build a world
We're out of time. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Jill Stein, the 2016 presidential candidate for the Green Party. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.